Welcome to our daily story brief. Today, we're tracking a huge shift in Washington. It's this really dramatic collision between raw political power, a massive bipartisan push in Congress, and, you know, the undeniable moral weight of Jeffrey Epstein's survivors.
Exactly. The big event is the House vote on the Epstein Files Transparency Act.
Mm-hmm.
And what makes this so stunning is the complete turnaround from President Donald Trump. For months, you have to remember, the administration fought this. They fought it tooth and nail.
Oh, absolutely. Their whole position was just dismissal. The president himself called the whole thing a Democrat hoax. He even said the files they were fighting to keep secret were, and this is a quote, pretty boring stuff.
And then almost overnight, that entire wall of opposition just crumbles. Yes. Over the weekend, he does a complete 180. He tells Republicans to vote for the bill, promises to sign it. It's a seismic shift.
Mm.
We have to ask, why? Why now?
And that's exactly what we're going to unpack for you today. We're going to look at the immense pressure that forced this change, the political fallout that's already happening, and maybe most importantly, these warnings we're hearing from lawmakers.
Right. The theory that this sudden support isn't about transparency at all,
yeah.
That it might actually be a very calculated last-ditch play to block the full story from ever coming out.
And the pressure... It wasn't just politics as usual. Sure, you had this powerful bipartisan team, you know, Representative Thomas Massie, a Republican, and Ro Khanna, a Democrat. But the thing that seems to have really broken the dam was the moral force of the survivors.
Them being there on Capitol Hill in person, forcing politicians to actually look them in the eye. That changed everything.
So let's start with the bill itself. The legislative vehicle here is the Epstein Files Transparency Act. What exactly would this force the government to do?
Well, the bill is very, very targeted. It tries to leave as little wiggle room as possible for the executive branch. Its main purpose is to compel the Department of Justice, the DOJ, to release all unclassified records from the Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell investigations.
And there's a deadline, right? It's not just an open-ended request.
It's a tight one. A 30-day clock starts the second the bill is signed into law. They want this stuff out, and they want it out now.
And it seems like the people who wrote this bill really learned from past document dumps where administrations, you know, they find ways to drag their feet or just black everything out.
Oh, they definitely did. The real teeth in this legislation come from one key prohibition. It's a provision that's designed to tie the hands of the administration.
And what does it say?
It specifically forbids the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, from withholding, delaying, or redacting any of these materials based on things like embarrassment.
Just simple embarrassment.
Right. Or reputational harm. Or, and this is the big one, political sensitivity.
So that's a direct shot at political stonewalling. It's basically Congress saying, we know the only reason you'd hide this stuff is to protect powerful people.
That's the message. But getting this bill to the floor at all was a huge fight, considering the opposition it faced early on.
Right. From the very top of House leadership.
Exactly. Speaker Mike Johnson, for instance. He'd previously stalled this whole effort. He even at one point cut a session short just to avoid having a vote on this exact bill.
Which makes his support now so remarkable. He says he'll vote for it, but he still called it recklessly flawed, kind of having it both ways.
He is, but that just shows you how much the political ground has shifted underneath him. The momentum became impossible to ignore. Representative Massie said he was hoping for a veto-proof majority.
So even if the president changed his mind again, it wouldn't matter.
Precisely. It would become law anyway.
Hmm.
This wasn't just about legislative maneuvering anymore. The moral pressure made opposing this bill politically toxic.
Let's talk about that moral force, because the statements from the survivors right before this vote were just incredibly powerful.
They were the centerpiece. I mean, they really forced the issue. You had survivors giving these unbelievably raw personal challenges to the entire political system. Haley Robson, she first met Epstein when she was just 16. She stood in front of the cameras, holding up a photo of herself as a teenager.
And she had a direct message for President Trump.
A very direct message. She just said, I am traumatized. I am not stupid.
Wow. I mean, a line like that just cuts through all the political noise, all the spin. It's a direct rebuttal to this idea that this is just a hoax or some kind of distraction.
And we heard the same kind of power from Jenalisa Jones, another survivor. She held up a photo of herself at 14. The age she was when she met Epstein. And her criticism was aimed right at the political games being played with these files. She said, I voted for you, but your behavior on this issue has been a national embarrassment.
And she didn't just ask for transparency. She was demanding that he take responsibility for his role in politicizing it. She told him, please stop making this political. It is not about you, President Trump.
Exactly. The sight of these women holding up these photos, this physical evidence of their own childhood, it just drove the point home. This fight belongs to them, the survivors, not to politicians who want to use it for political points.
And another survivor, Lisa Phillips, she announced they were forming a new movement.
Yeah, a nonpartisan survivor-led movement. She said, this fight belongs to us. We lived it and we know the truth, and we will not wait quietly for institutions to decide when we're allowed to speak.
You can't ignore that. When the people at the heart of the story say that the system, regardless of party, has failed them again and again, that creates a mandate for action that very few politicians can afford to resist.
And that moral pressure is what leads us right into the turnaround itself, the Trump turnaround.
Mm.
Because for months, as we said, the administration's policy was just total resistance.
Yeah, let's detail that resistance first. Just how deep was the opposition before this sudden flip?
Oh, it was fierce. It was sustained. Trump wasn't just dismissing it. He was actively attacking it, repeatedly calling it a Democrat hoax.
And he didn't just attack Democrats, right? He went after people in his own party.
He did. Most famously, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. She had been one of his most loyal, most vocal allies. And he called her a traitor simply for pushing for transparency on this.
He was really trying to control the entire narrative, to push it away from Epstein entirely.
Completely. The goal is to talk about anything else. He explicitly said he didn't want the Epstein files to detract from the great success of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Even as late as September, he was still calling it a Democrat hoax that never ends.
Mm.
This was a months-long systematic effort to just bury the whole thing.
So given that level of dedication to suppressing it, the reversal over the weekend is just,
It's
mind-boggling. How did he actually do it?
It was a classic social media pivot. He put out a statement telling House Republicans to vote yes. His justification was, quote, we have nothing to hide, and he promised he'd sign the bill.
But at the same time, he tried to reframe the whole scandal.
Immediately. He tried to frame it as really a Democrat problem. He pointed fingers directly at Epstein's known ties to former President Bill Clinton and to Larry Summers.
Okay, hold on. Let's play devil's advocate for a second. If the files really do implicate people like Clinton and Summers, isn't it just smart politics for him to support the release and use it to attack his rivals? Why does this reversal have to signal something sinister, like obstruction, instead of just being, you know, a clever political move?
And that is the central question we have to look at. You're right. It could be read that way. Co-opting a popular bill to hurt your enemies. But the reason for the skepticism is all about the timing and the method. If he truly wanted these files out to damage Democrats, he has the executive power to just order their release. He could have done it 4 months ago.
Or yesterday.
Or right now. The fact that he waited until he was forced into it by his own party and by survivor pressure, it suggests this is a reactive move, not a proactive one.
And how did his supporters in the media spin it?
The MANGA media ecosystem went into overdrive immediately, framing it as some kind of brilliant strategic move. You had Fox News hosts saying he was calling their bluff or pulling a reverse on Democrats.
The idea being he's proving he has nothing to hide.
Exactly. The official White House line was that Trump has long been calling for transparency, which is just verifiably false, and that this House vote was just a Democrat distraction that he was now putting to bed.
But the pressure on him wasn't just political. There was that really intense incident on Air Force One that kind of reveals the tension behind the scenes.
Right, the incident with the Bloomberg reporter Jennifer Jacobs. And she wasn't even asking about what's in the files. She was asking the logical follow-up question. If you have nothing to hide, why not use your executive authority and just release them yourself? Why wait for Congress?
Which is the question that exposes the contradiction in his new position. So how did he react?
It was an explosion. According to several people who were there, before she could even finish her question, he just lashed out at her. He told her, quiet, quiet, Piggy.
It's an insult he's used before, but deploying it there, in that moment, against a reporter asking that specific question, that's very telling.
It's incredibly telling. That raw moment, you know, lashing out like that, probably tells you more about the real pressure he's feeling than any official statement about having nothing to hide.
Uh-huh.
It shows this issue is personal for him. It's volatile. And that specific question about his own power to act clearly hit a major nerve.
Which brings us right to the most serious theory here, the one that challenges the entire premise of his reversal. The smokescreen theory. The idea that this is all just a new, more clever form of obstruction.
And that's exactly what Representative Thomas Massie has been warning about. The core argument against Trump's sincerity is very simple. He has the power to release these files today. We saw him do it earlier this year with the JFK files, the RFK files, the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination files.
So why wait for a bill? A bill his own administration fought against until the very last second.
A political strategist put it pretty bluntly. If Trump wanted this out, he would have done it months ago or, quote, right now. So if it's not about real transparency, what is this last gasp plan that Massey's talking about?
What's the specific concern?
Massey's fear is about a legal loophole, that the administration seems to have conveniently created for itself just moments before this reversal. Right before he pledged to support the bill, Trump publicly directed Attorney General Pam Bondi to open a bunch of brand new investigations into Epstein's connections.
And who are the targets of these new investigations?
They are very specific high-profile Democrats, former President Bill Clinton, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, and the founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman.
Okay, so here's where it gets a little complicated. How does opening a new investigation into Democrats help you block the release of files that could implicate anyone, Republican or Democrat?
This is the genius of the plan, if that's what it is. This is the mechanism Massey is raising the alarm about. The law has a very important exception. The Justice Department can withhold or heavily redact any materials if releasing them would harm an ongoing investigation.
So by starting these new investigations, even if they're just for show,
the DOJ now has what's called a legal predicate for not releasing the files. They've created their own excuse.
So let's walk through an example. A document comes up that has embarrassing information about a Republican official, but it also has a passing mention of Bill Clinton. Under this theory, the attorney general could withhold the whole document, claiming it's part of the ongoing Clinton investigation.
That is precisely the fear. The argument would be that releasing document A could somehow tip off the targets in the new investigation into Democrat X or Y. The new transparency bill, remember, it says you can't withhold things for political embarrassment. But it doesn't, and probably can't, override the long-standing legal protection for ongoing investigations. They seem to be weaponizing a standard legal procedure for political ends.
The skepticism is definitely warranted, but let me push back on this for a moment. Couldn't his supporters argue that if he had released the files on his own unilaterally, he'd be accused of politicizing the DOJ right before an election? You know, selectively leaking things to hurt his enemies.
That is a fair point, and it does show the bind that the executive is in here. Yes, if he had just ordered them out, critics would have screamed that he was cherry-picking the documents. But the optics of what he actually did, fighting a bipartisan bill until the last minute, then supporting it, while simultaneously creating a legal escape hatch, that suggests the goal here is control, not transparency.
And legal watchdogs are pointing to his past behavior as a reason for concern, specifically that pluck-out story about the classified documents.
Yes, that comparison keeps coming up because it's so relevant to the theory of what might happen here. You have the documented instance of Trump allegedly telling his lawyer to just pluck out anything really bad from the classified documents that he was supposed to return. It suggests a mindset of selective filtering, of concealment, rather than just outright destruction.
So the fear isn't that they'll shred the Epstein files.
The fear is that they'll use this legal cover, this ongoing investigation, to heavily redact them or to pluck out the really damaging parts claiming they're vital to a protected inquiry. It's obstruction through selective compliance.
And even with this new law, there are other legal tools the DOJ can use, right? The attorney general still has a lot of power over what actually sees the light of day.
A ton of power. Former U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid made this point very clearly. Even with this new act, the DOJ can still redact information citing things like grand jury secrecy or basic privacy laws.
Can you explain grand jury secrecy in this context? How would that apply here?
It's a fundamental principle of the legal system. The proceedings of a grand jury are secret to protect witnesses and people who aren't charged. Since a lot of the evidence in the Epstein and Maxwell cases was presented to a grand jury, Bondi could argue that releasing those specific materials would violate that secrecy rule, regardless of what the new Transparency Act says.
And what about documents that might mention the president himself?
McQuaid thinks those could absolutely be withheld or redacted. As long as there's any related criminal investigation open, like the new ones into Democrats, Bondi could block the release of information about anyone who isn't being charged, including Trump. She could do it under the guise of protecting their privacy during a related inquiry.
So the bill tries to stop withholding for political sensitivity, But it doesn't touch these other longstanding federal rules. It creates this very clear path for them to comply with the letter of the law while violating its spirit.
Exactly. And that's not even getting into the physical risk of documents being altered or destroyed, which is, you know, a huge felony.
Hmm.
The Democracy Defenders Fund even filed a lawsuit to try to get court supervision over this process to prevent exactly that.
Because their fear isn't just destruction.
Right. Norm Eisen, who co-founded the group, said, "The biggest danger is them wrongly withholding them or producing and redacting them.
Hmm.
It's the filtering that's the real threat. It's much harder to prove and much easier to get away with."
Let's shift a little bit to the political fallout, because this whole thing has ripped open a huge divide. Some are calling it the crack in the dam of the whole Magier movement.
That's a good way to put it. The commentator Scott Moorfield used that exact phrase. Because this issue puts two core Magie principles in direct conflict. On one hand, you have the populist desire to drain the swamp, to expose corrupt elites. This fits that perfectly. But on the other hand, you have the political need to protect the leader and his powerful allies. They're colliding head on.
And the most public, most visible example of that collision is the feud between President Trump and Marjorie Taylor Greene. I mean, she was arguably one of his biggest champions in Congress.
And their clash has been spectacular. It really lays the whole dilemma bare. Trump calls her a traitor for demanding transparency. He defines loyalty as defending the administration's position. No questions asked.
But her response was incredibly powerful. She basically redefined patriotism in her rebuttal.
She did. She held that press conference with the survivor standing right behind her. And she's, and I'm quoting here, "I was called a traitor by a man that I fought for six years for. A patriot is an American that serves the United States of America and Americans like the women standing behind me."
That's a direct challenge to his definition of loyalty. She's saying loyalty to the American people, to victims, has to come before personal loyalty to a political leader.
And that is a huge rupture. It forces a lot of his supporters to choose between their anti-establishment gut feeling and their personal devotion to Trump. And you could see the survivors behind her. They were lauding her, thanking her for having the courage to stand up to him on this. She really flipped the script.
Even Speaker Mike Johnson, his support for the bill was so reluctant. He said he'd vote for it, but in the same breath called it a political showboat and recklessly flawed. What was his main issue with it?
His stated concern was about protecting victims and whistleblowers. He said he wants the Senate to amend the bill to make sure that the information that comes out doesn't accidentally cause more harm to the very people it's supposed to help.
Which sounds reasonable on the surface, but the bill's sponsors, Massey and Khanna, they sent a pretty clear warning to the Senate about those kinds of amendments.
A very blunt warning. Their message was basically, don't muck it up. They told the Senate not to get too cute and start adding amendments just to slow things down or water down the bill. They argued that the same public pressure that forced Trump and Johnson to fold will come for any senator who tries to weaken it.
Massey had a great line. He said that the people raising problems are afraid that people will be embarrassed. Well, that's the whole point here.
And that's the whole fight in a nutshell. The entire purpose of the bill is to reveal the embarrassing, politically sensitive stuff. The opposition, even when they're pretending to support it, is trying to find ways to soften that blow. The next big battle will be over the fine print in the Senate.
And while all this is happening, we can't forget that the documents that have already been released by the House Oversight Committee are causing massive damage.
Right. And that damage plays perfectly into the administration's news story, that this is all a Democrat problem. It's no coincidence that Trump's new investigations targeted the exact people who feature heavily in those already public records. Bill Clinton, Reid Hoffman, and especially Larry Summers.
And Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, has faced the most immediate and severe consequences so far, hasn't he?
The fallout for him was instant, and it was brutal. It really shows just how toxic any association with Epstein has become. Summers, you know, he's a Harvard professor. He served in the Clinton and Obama administrations at the highest levels. And he announced he was stepping back from public commitments to try to rebuild trust.
He put out a pretty strong apology.
He did. He said he was deeply ashamed and took full responsibility for my misguided decision to continue communicating with Mr. Epstein. It was a full-on public mea culpa.
So what did the emails actually show that prompted that?
they showed that Summers was in active, regular contact with Epstein right up until a few days before Epstein's arrest in 2019. And this is the critical part. This was all happening long after Epstein's 2008 conviction for sex crimes with a minor.
And it wasn't just, what, professional correspondence?
Not even close. They talked about everything. Politics projects at Harvard and women. The emails show Summers was actually asking Epstein for romantic advice. It's just staggering.
A former Treasury secretary, a top Harvard academic, asking a convicted sex offender for dating tips? That imagery alone is just so incredibly damaging.
It confirms this idea that there was this bubble of invincibility around Epstein, that even after he was a convicted felon, the elite still treated him as a peer. And that context led to immense political pressure. Senator Elizabeth Warren immediately called for Harvard to fire him.
Her argument being that his judgment is just fundamentally broken?
Exactly. She said if he couldn't see the problem with cozying up to a convicted sex offender, then he has no business advising policymakers or teaching students. And that pressure is a direct result of just 20,000 pages of documents being released. That makes you wonder, what's in the 300 gigabytes the DOJ is still sitting on?
We also have to touch on that one really sensational detail that blew up everywhere, the Bubba email that John Stewart talked about.
Right. That came from an email between Jeffrey Epstein and his brother, Mark. And the line was, ask him if Putin has the photos of Trump blowing Bubba. Stewart used it to completely dismantle Trump's claim that the files were pretty boring stuff.
Now, Mark Epstein did come out and clarify that, right? That Bubba wasn't Bill Clinton.
He did. He said it was a non-public figure and that the email was just part of a private joke between them. But as Stewart pointed out, who Bubba is almost doesn't matter. The real takeaway is just how comfortable they were having these kinds of shocking, explicit conversations about espionage and powerful people long after Epstein was a convicted criminal. They had no fear of being held accountable.
They felt completely untouchable.
And that really speaks to the total failure of the justice system to properly punish him the first time, which just allowed him to keep his network going for another decade.
And finally, there's the international dimension here, specifically with Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor, the former Prince Andrew. Congress is looking at him very closely.
They are. The House Oversight Committee is actively trying to get him to sit for a deposition. They're accusing him of hiding and dodging their requests, which shows you how far this scandal reaches.
What's the evidence they're citing to pressure him?
They're pointing to financial records they've obtained. Records that have notations like, massage for Andrew.
Yeah.
They say those notations raise serious questions. One committee member said Andrew is just hiding from us, and that every time they dig up more evidence, his name seems to pop up. It's not going away for him.
So as we get closer to this vote in the House, we're left with this huge political and legal mess. It's a situation that could undermine the whole point of the bill before it even becomes law.
That's the dilemma. It's exactly what Massey warned about. The public is demanding transparency. Congress is about to vote for it overwhelmingly. The president says he'll sign it. But at the very same time, the administration has built this legal escape hatch. These new investigations into Democrats give Attorney General Bondi the perfect, legally defensible excuse to withhold the most sensitive files.
So we could win the battle, pass the bill, but still lose the war for transparency. We might just get a trickle of heavily redacted documents. It's compliance as a form of control.
And we have to remember the sheer scale of what we're talking about. The DOJ has confirmed it has over 300 gigabytes of data beyond the 50,000 pages we've already seen. One federal judge estimated there could be over 100,000 pages of files in total. We have seen almost nothing.
That volume alone guarantees this story isn't going away. Even Trump's own advisors are apparently worried that releasing some of the files won't be enough because the public believes, rightly or wrongly, that the really damning stuff is still hidden.
And the whole point of this bill was to force the release of documents based on that very idea of political sensitivity. And when you look at all the maneuvering we've discussed, the feuds, the reversal, the public humiliation, the creation of legal loopholes, it really raises a fundamental question for our system.
Jizz. What is the real cost of total unredacted transparency? And is our political system actually built to survive that kind of shock?
The system is being stress tested right now by this clash between moral outrage and political self-preservation. The question for you as a listener isn't just about whether the bill passes. It's about how effective this smokescreen plan will be. How much will they be able to hide using these loopholes? And what kind of crisis will be triggered the next time a piece of this story, no matter how filtered, finally gets out? The fight for real accountability, it seems, is only just beginning.